This is 4:55 on Wednesday, October 26th. All right, good morning. I wanted to sort of review where we stand with respect to what's happening. Today is the 26th. We are going to talk about the link layer over the next four lectures or so. I will assign the Chapter 5 problems later today, like right after class. Notice that they are due on Friday of next week, so there aren't so many problems in this set. But it does pose, again, the problem that the assignment is due, and then there's the exam. And so I will post the solutions for Chapter 5 on Saturday, Saturday the 5th, and that means that I can't accept late submissions of Chapter 5, right? So just be aware that if you're going to get what little credit there is for Chapter 5, that you need to turn it in on time. Okay, the exam is 2 weeks from last Monday, and it will cover sort of all the stuff in after the first exam and up to that point, which will be essentially the network and link layers. Questions about this? Okay, questions about what we talked about last time? Everybody understands Select perfectly.
Are we going to go over Receive?
We are going to go over Receive Message right almost instantly now. Yes. And a few other utility things. Yes, we need to do that, and we need to finish up Multicast today before we start on the link layer. So, let's talk about Receive. If you look up in the man pages for Receive From, it looks like this. So the initial set of arguments up to that point are just the same as Receive, right? There's a socket, a buffer, the size of the buffer, and some flags. But the new thing is that there's a struct socadder. Star source adder. And then all right. So Receive From is a very close cousin of Receive. If you look in the Unix man pages, they're even documented on the same man page. And the difference is these additional arguments that are a struct, a pointer to getter, and a pointer to the length of the struct sock getter. Notice that it's a pointer to the pointer to the length and not the length. And it works like Receive. When you call it, it waits for a message to arrive on, waits for data to be available on the socket. And when there is data available, it puts it in the buffer, and it tells you in its return value how many bytes it received. Okay. So it's just like Receive. In addition, it fills in struct socadder with the address information that corresponds to who sent the message. And so it will be an IP for an IP domain socket. It will be an IP address and a socket. Okay, simple enough. And then it changes. You need to tell it how big this struct sock adder is. So you know size of struct sock adder or size of star or whatever you pass to this. You need to tell it how big it is by passing a pointer to that length, and it will tell you how many bytes it actually filled in by changing the value that's referred to by that pointer. Okay? So, you know, it's just mungy, grungy, C-level pointers and pointers and buffers and all that stuff. And let's look at a picture now of why you need to use this. Okay? I realized that I never actually drew a picture of what it is that you're building in this project, right? So, what you're building in this project is a collection of routers. Boy, I could, with Halloween approaching, I could maybe do something with that, but I won't. R1. Thank you. Did I hear thank? All right. Okay, so we've got a bunch of routers. Each of these is a Unix or Windows process, and each of them has two sockets. There's what's called the command socket, and there's what's called the update socket. I don't know. It's getting kind of suspicious looking. All right. And these, the C's and the U's are datagram sockets, not stream sockets. And the idea is that all of the routers talk to each other by sending messages to one another on their update ports. And as we said, the router code, when it finds that there's something readable on that update port, will read it and then has to look at it. There's nothing in the message that says where it came from, and yet you need to know where it came from in order to update your data structures. So that's where RISC-V comes into play. You'll do a receive from on this socket and find out that it came, say, from R3 by looking at the IP address and port number that you got. And you will thereby be able to update the data structures in R1 that you know are about R3. Okay, got it? That's the picture. The command sockets are talked to by various other little programs. Print tables, change link. All of those little programs send messages to the command sockets. And those are not particularly, where they came from is not particularly interesting in that case. But in the case of the update sockets, it is interesting where the message came from. Okay? So hopefully that gives you a better sense of what this whole thing is going to look like. These processes can be all on the same machine. They can be on different machines, sort of up to you. The scripts that I've provided are all oriented around running them on the same machine. But I thought I saw a hand go up. Guess not. Questions about this? So, you are going to be, hopefully, starting to work on this pretty soon. As questions come up, bring them up in class, please. If you're having questions about something, it's likely that at least one other person is having a similar question. So bring it up in class and don't be shy about that. I've taken students through this enough times that I know what some of the questions are likely to be, and I've tried to cover all of those, but there may be others, so let me know. Okay.
All right. Next thing. I promised to tell you about some interesting tools that are available, or programs that are available on at least Linux and Unixy machines, and on Windows you can probably find similar programs. So one of them is this program Tmux. So Tmux, the T stands for terminal and mux stands for multiplexer. And the idea of Tmux is that you can have multiple windows, all talking to different shells, but all within the same window. Or I shouldn't say multiple windows. Multiple, I think they call them screens. Talking to different instances of your shell or whatever, all within the same window. So you start it up and you get something that looks like this. And I don't want to do that, so let's CD CSV5, it's AL. Okay, so there's my first one, and then if you say Control B C, you get another one. Okay, so it's still in the same window, but now I have two shells going in the same window, and you see down here at the bottom it tells me that I'm talking to the second one at the moment and not to the first one. I could switch back to the first one by saying Control B 0, and then I'm back there. Now, why is this interesting for this project? Well, you're likely to want to run your routers, at least in the early stages, in their own windows. And if you have to sort of switch back and forth and reorder windows all the time in order to find them, that can be kind of a pain in the neck. So this may be an easier way to sort of bounce around between a lot of windows, because you can just switch windows switch shells with a keystroke, or a couple of keystrokes. So that's handy. Questions about that? There's a man page for it. And unfortunately, it's way more complicated in its capabilities than what I've described or what you're ever likely to use, but you can sort of page through the man page and see some of the things it's capable of. Oh, it has one other endearing feature, which maybe isn't so relevant for this project, but you may want to know about in general. That is, if I say Tmux A, A stands for attach, and it will attach to an already running Tmux session on the same machine. So this is the session that runs the Qlix server, I guess. No, this is the session that runs my private version of the web page. And I just reconnected to it from here, even though it's running normally on my Office machine. So if you have an instance where you want to move around and still be able to get to something that's terminal-ish running on some machine, that can be very handy. The other one here, Control B 0. This is the shell in which I do the AV conversion for the video and audio files, and I never remember the exact commands for doing that. But by having this running all the time, I can just sort of go back to them and catch them from wherever I happen to be, which is handy. Okay? So, and then to disconnect from that, you say Control B D, and we're back there. It's still running over there where it was before, and I'm no longer interacting with it. So that could be handy for some purposes that you have, but I don't necessarily think it is for this project. Okay? That's Tmux. Next one is T, right? Everybody know about T? A program that reads from standard inputs and writes to standard output and also puts the output into a file. So remember, one of the things that you're required to do
is give me some logs about what your routers are producing. This is the way to do it. To be able to see those output and see that output, and we also need to record it. So T will let you do that. You know, you just run your router, you say pipe into T, and then give the file name that you want it to go into. And that's what you need to do. You probably want, since you need to put all the output into the same file, ultimately, you may want to use the append switch so that all the routers write into the same file without reducing bytes when they start up. And that's T. Okay, questions about T? That's a very classic Unix program from the very, very early days. People recognize that that was a useful thing to do. Okay, and the last one is even simpler. TS is timestamp. And the way I've assigned the behavior of the router this time, it already has to produce some timestamps on its own. You have to read the time and format them from within the program. But if you want to just generally add timestamps in the front of lines that are being produced by a program, you can pipe them into TS and read about the behavior of the switches. Okay? Cool? Here, let's do an example. Okay? It's pretty boring because it doesn't really, you know, probably produced all that output within 1 second, so the case of LS, but other things are possible. And you can pass in formats that only print the number of seconds or different things. Any questions about those? Very handy to know about for this and other things. Then moving on, let's finish up talking about multicast. So we had talked about, we were looking at this picture, and we had talked about controlled flooding, and controlling flooding by keeping track of packets that have already been forwarded and not forwarding those, or using this reverse path trick, only forwarding something that arrives on the shortest path from the source. Hard time, right? But then the sort of high-quality way of doing this is to construct what's called a spanning tree. So I think I asked you before what was the difference between a general graph and a tree. A tree has no loops. Right? It's a graph with no loops. It's also connected in other things. So we take our general graph, and we select some edges so that it's still connected, but there are no loops. That's a spanning tree. There are algorithms for creating spanning trees, and there are different ways of creating spanning trees, but the idea is this, that when we use the spanning tree idea, we only forward messages along the spanning tree edges. If we do that, notice, there's no chance that a node will get the packet from two different directions. It always comes from one direction. It never gets two packets. This is the elegant way of doing this, provided you can spanning tree. How do you create one? Well, usually there's a spanning tree protocol that behaves something like either sending a message, everybody sends a message to one node, and as it encounters, I think there's an animation here, as it encounters different edges that are already part of the tree, it adds them. Sorry, as the message encounters edges that are not part of the tree, it adds those edges to the tree. And if it encounters a node that's already part of the tree, it stops. Okay?
So that way you end up with
a tree.
You might think about proving to yourself that that really is a tree and not a general graph that loops. And then once we have that, getting ahead of myself. That's the general idea of constructing a spanning tree. Now let's switch from broadcast to multicast and see what changes.
So the difference between broadcast and multicast is that with multicast, some of the nodes are not interested in the messages. One way to put it. And we don't necessarily want to deliver the messages to those nodes if they're not interested. Now, the interested nodes have been shown here in red. Then the problem becomes, well, which routers should be part of the multicast tree? And notice that certainly if a router has an attached node that wants to participate, it's red. But here's a router that has no nodes interested in the multicast, and we don't actually want to forward any messages to that router because that router has nowhere to send them on to, so why bother? So what we do in that case is we go through a step of sort of building the multicast forwarding tree in the same way that we talked about before, and then routers that have no interest send what are called prune messages to their parent in the graph, saying, oh, forget about me, never mind. Okay. And so this router probably started out as part of the multicast tree, the things with the big fat red edges, but then said, well, there's nobody here who cares about that, so forget it. Okay.
And so then the messages stop going. All right. I think we won't talk about that. Oh, let's just talk about this briefly.
Remember when we constructed routing tables by Dijkstra's algorithm? Essentially the same thing works here. If this is the source of a multicast, we can build a shortest path multicast tree that in which the packets follow the shortest path to every node, okay? Using essentially Dijkstra's algorithm. Same idea. That construction is usually associated with a situation in which we have an identified source that will be where all the multicasts will come from. The other possibility is in a multicast group like this, that any node wants to be able to send to the group, in which case we have a shared multicast tree. The optimization problem there is harder. It is what is known as the Steiner tree problem. This multicast tree is optimal for this source, but it may not be optimal for other sources. But you could use it. It would work okay.
It just might not be optimal. Okay, reverse path forwarding, sort of like reverse path flooding. Let's not worry about that. But here's the last thing to say about multicast. So the internet is not well equipped with multicast forwarding routers. Most providers don't want to play in multicast in a general way. So what are we to do if WSU to have a multicast group, say, that spans this campus and Vancouver and Spokane, and those are just connected by ordinary non-multicast capable routers? Well, we do that thing that we talked about before. Remember, we talked about how are we going to deal with IPv6? What did we do? We want IPv6 or IPv4 networks. What do we do? We wrap it into a IPv4, in the case of IPv6, message. In this case, we wrap it into a non-multicast message and forward it from one multicast capable router to another one as a unicast message, which then unpacks it and does multicast on the other end. Okay, so the key word is tunneling, and tunneling is nothing more than wrapping messages in another protocol, sending them across, unpacking them, and carrying on as if nothing had happened. I'm not going to talk about PIN. That's it for chapter 4. Okay, so what do I want you to know about multicast? I want and broadcast. I want you to know about the problems associated with flooding, uncontrolled flooding. What happens? How does it break? What are some things that we can do to fix that? You should know about pruning, tree construction and tree pruning based on disinterest from different routers.
Yeah,
I think that's the main set of things. I will just mention that there's a subset of the IPv4 addresses that is reserved for doing multicast. So everybody will know that the addresses that start 224 dot something or other are multicast addresses. And like I said, most places in the backbone are not very interested in actually forwarding those, because you have to be willing to go through this process of building the spanning tree and figuring out who it is that wants those messages, and that's complicated. So they don't want to do any complication, they just want to forward packets and collect money. They like to do. Any questions about this? It's the network layer. Yeah. In a unicast message.
So does it get unwrapped in every router?
No. Let me draw a picture. It's very that picture that we looked at for IPv6. Okay, so we send a message in here, multicast. We wrap it in a unicast message. This is our original message. We wrap it in a unicast message that is addressed to this router. Okay? So it passes transparently through the circle routers. This router, being multicast capable, says, oh, that's a wrapped multicast message. It unpacks it and carries on with multicast.
And is the destination router that's within the routing table that knows about the multicast router?
So this routing table has to say, for a particular multicast address, one of the things you need to do with it is send it to this guy. And the way that you do that is by tunneling. Because the other possibility is that we could just have sort of an ordinary bunch of multicast routers as well. Okay. Other questions? Good. So let's start on chapter 5. Okay, so this top-down approach, we did the network layer, the next thing is the link layer. What do you think we need to talk about with respect to the link layer? And what sort of link layers are we going to talk about? Any thoughts? What are some example link layers? Okay, Ethernet is one, definitely. What else?
Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi, that's another good one. What else? How do you get internet service at your house? Modems, okay, so serial modems, that's pretty ancient technology these days, but still used in some places. That's a kind of link layer. What else?
Cable
networking, right? Cable, over TV cables. So that's another kind of link layer. What else? Is anybody unfortunate enough to be a freshman? What? What?
DSL,
yeah. Okay, that's another one. Then there are some more esoteric ones like SONET, which is a sort of low-level link layer protocol over fiber optics. And then there's the link layers that are implemented as network layers of some other networking protocol, like ATM is an example of this, where from the IP perspective, it's used as a link layer, but if you talk to an ATM enthusiast, ATM could be a network layer in and of itself. MPLS, similarly, etc. Okay? So there are a whole bunch of link layers. And we're going to talk about some of the ways that these are all similar to each other and some of the differences that arise. And some of the services that we talked about of being at the network layer and even at the transport layer might also be implemented at the link layer. So, for example, we talked about TCP having reliable delivery, right? Reliable in-order delivery. And in the internet protocol stack, that's required, right? It's required that TCP have this behavior of making reliable delivery. But there's nothing to say that maybe in some situations you also want to have reliability at the link layer or at the network layer. So we're going to talk a little bit about issues of reliability as they show up at the link layer. And that's this stuff about error detection and correction. Error detection and correction. Another problem is that at the link layer with something like Ethernet, remember Ethernet is sort of fundamentally a shared medium. If I send a signal on an Ethernet or I send a signal on Wi-Fi, who is supposed to respond to that signal? How do I identify who is supposed to respond to that signal? That's the addressing problem. So we have addressing at the network layer, where we use IPv4 or IPv6 addresses, but we also have addressing at the link layer, and the addressing is different at the link layer, so we'll talk about that. And then the other issue is, if we all share a medium, like the space in this room for audio signals, there needs to be some protocol that says who gets to talk. Otherwise, at any given time, otherwise we could all be talking at once and nobody could understand what was going on. So, process by which we share what's called a broadcast channel is also important. We'll talk about that. And then we'll talk about a few examples of these things. Okay. So that's the outline. So once again, the hosts and the nodes. Let's go to a full screen view. Once again, the hosts and the routers are called nodes. Surprise. And the link layer is about the connections between adjacent places in the network. So this router talking to this router, over what means does it detect? Is it Ethernet? Is it Wi-Fi? Is it DSL? What is it? Physically adjacent. Well, it's kind of funny. A link layer has responsibility for transferring a datagram from one node to a physically adjacent node over a link. In some sense, the links are the things that define what is physically adjacent. Right? If there's no link, they're not physically adjacent. You have to move to the network layer. And the terminology is that the things, the packets at this layer 2 are called frames. And inside the frames, we have an encapsulated datagram from the network layer, at least in the case of questions about this.
Just, you need to know that terminology.
Okay. I don't know. Once again, I find their transportation analogies kind of hokey. I don't think they help very much, but they do that. Okay, so how does it work? So we're talking about layers here. So we started out with some data at the application level. We passed it down to the transport layer, which put a transport layer header on it, and passed it down to the network layer, which put a network layer header on it, which passes it down to the link layer, which puts a link layer header on it. And now, at the link layer, we start sometimes talking about not only headers, but also trailers. Right? Some data that goes at the beginning of the packet and some that goes at the end. And this has to do often with just the problem of figuring out where packets or frames start and end. Helpful to have some few bits at the end to say. Okay, so we do that, we pass those down. Then, if we have a so-called broadcast channel, we have to figure out when it's our turn to talk about that. And we have to put an address in the encapsulating data in order to identify where it's coming from and where it's going. Now, some link layers provide reliable delivery between adjacent nodes. And examples of this are the Sonnet fiber optic rings. They have mechanisms built into the link layer to do reliable delivery. Not clear what the big benefit of that is, but they sort of started out building that network. Building that link layer with the idea that it would need to be, and it's not that hard to do, so they just keep doing it. The other place that you see reliable delivery, at least to a certain extent, is with wireless links. And the problem with wireless links is that they tend to have high error rates, which lead to dropped packets. Okay? And you might say, well, we have TCP. If we want reliability, why don't we rely on TCP instead of building a reliability mechanism in the wireless link?
So why? So here's what I want you to think about in this regard. What do dropped packets mean at the TCP level? How are dropped packets interpreted by TCP? What does it think they mean?
It never made it, and there was never. So if it was lost at the last link all the way there, then it has to go all the way back from the client and resend to the host. But if the link layer could say, oh, well, I made it most of the way there, can I check and try and resend to the closest?
Okay, so that's one good reason for this. It's not the answer to the question, what does a drop packet mean to TCP? How does TCP interpret drop packets? Yeah.
Congestion,
right? Very specifically, when TCP encounters dropped packets, it interprets it as congestion. And therefore will tend to want to back down on the sending rate, right? Because that's what TCP does when it encounters congestion. It's not clear for a lot of wireless links that congestion is the issue that's causing the dropped packets. It might be, but it also might not be. It could just be sort of interference from microwave ovens and other things, where what you really want to do in response to those kind of interference is just be as aggressive as possible to overcome them. And TCP will tend to be very polite and say, oh, that was congestion, I've got to slow down. And that's the wrong response. So the two things are what Andrew mentioned, which is we've invested all these resources in a packet, and now it's been lost over the link layer. If we rely on TCP to recover from that, we sort of force more data into the network for no good reason. And the second one is that lost packets do not always mean congestion, and that's what TCP will interpret it as, and then behave incorrectly. When we were building some of the very early wireless networks at Xerox PARC, this is exactly what we ran into. They didn't have reliability built in at the link layer, and what we found was that you couldn't get anything done over them because of the various kinds of interference, which just caused TCP to get slower and slower and slower, even though the network was in fact not particularly congested. Okay, so that's why both things, they solve different problems. Okay. You can implement at the link layer some flow. This is seen more in sort of serial modem based link layers than in anything else. I don't think of any. Oh well, okay. So yeah, no, I don't think of any flow control except in serial link layers. Remember, it doesn't mention there's also congestion control that's implemented at the link layer, particularly in the case of Wi-Fi, wireless Ethernet. They have some mechanisms for flow control, for congestion control. Okay, so if we're going to be ready for what could happen in the link layer, even if a link layer is pretty darn reliable in terms of delivering what I put into it to the other end, we still have to be prepared for the fact that a cosmic ray interfered with the fiber optics or the wire and caused a bit to be changed. It may not happen very often, but we don't want to sort of proceed assuming that it hasn't happened. So most link layers have some form of what's called detection, and we're going to talk about how that works at the beginning next time. Some form of error detection that causes either a retransmission, in the case that we are after a reliable link layer, or just dropping the frame. But investing more resources in sending a damaged frame further is not worth anybody's time, right? Because it ultimately gets thrown away at the end based on the transport layer checksums, say. Okay? So we have the transport layer checksums so that we don't deliver bad data to applications. Don't want to do that. So that's error detection. Another possibility is to use even more heavy-duty mechanisms sort of along the lines of error detection to accomplish error correction, which is a way to, especially on high error rate networks, avoid having to retransmit data that has been damaged, but instead fix it at the other end. And we'll talk about how that works. And finally, the final issue is just a little bit of terminology. You'll hear people talking about half duplex communication and full duplex communication and simplex communication. Okay. So what is simplex? We'll start with simplex, which is not up here. Simplex communication is communication that goes one direction only. So think of broadcast radio, or broadcast television. That's simplex communication. It comes from the broadcast station to you. You don't send anything back. Half duplex communication is a situation in which the same resources are used for sending from me to you and from you to me, but we can't both talk at the same time. Okay? So I talk, then you talk, then I talk, then you talk. That's so-called half duplex communication. And full duplex communication allows us both to talk to each other at the same time. And the model for the mental model for the internet, at least, is full duplex communication. Those TCP streams, remember, they set up a connection that allows me to talk to you and you to talk to me over the same TCP connection. Not all media support full duplex communication. Old-fashioned bus-based Ethernet, for example, only lets one device on the network talk at once. More modern versions of Ethernet actually do allow full duplex communication. I can be talking to you, you to me at the same time over the same physical resources, and it works. Where is it implemented? Well, you should be able to point to the place on your laptop where it's implemented. I guess unless it's wireless, in which case maybe you only have a guess as to where the actual device is, but typically it's a piece of hardware that is attached to the system, to which the CPU can send bytes and commands, and that the physical device will sort of package up the bits onto the physical medium and accomplish both the physical layer and the link layer in the same state. All right. I think I need to stop. Try to be on time this week more. And we'll go on next time and talk about error detection. That's this first step. Yeah. I still have to get up at 3 a.m. to figure out 422 and they couldn't figure it out.